easy to become a BAI buddy. Just go to WBAI.org and you can't miss the big notice about Women's History Month and this special offer. That's $15 a month on your credit card, less than 50 cents a day. So honor those women, honor community-supported radio, and become a BAI buddy today. This is Patty Wood from Green Street, and this has been a profile in women's history over listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
I'm seeing a brand new day with women in control, a world where people get along, where war takes no toll. The sun shining brightly on every soul on earth, and every child knows deep inside their value and their worth. We're making our own way, move it upward every day. We don't care what people say, a woman knows her place. We're working day and night, all to make the wrong things right. We will keep on with the fight, a woman knows her place.
And you're listening to WBAI in New York. Hang on, we'll get to Democracy Now! Instantaneously.
You are tuned to WBAI.
I want my freedom!
New York.
Ah! Ah!
99.5 FM.
You gotta get me my freedom!
Streaming on www.wbai.org. Freedom of Speech Radio.
Next on What's the Frequency, Kenneth?
Ultimately, it is Ukraine that will have to make its own sovereign decisions about the shape of any diplomacy going forward. From the United States' perspective, we're here to stay in touch with all the key players, as you mentioned, the French, the Germans, the Israelis, others, but ultimately to support the Ukrainians. And as things stand right now, Vladimir Putin does not look like he is prepared to stop the onslaught. And so we will continue to escalate the pressure against him and continue to support the Ukrainians as they fight to defend their territory.
I'm Paul Fisher.
We've been warning since well before this invasion got underway in February that the plans for this invasion involved Russia attacking all over Ukraine, southern Ukraine, eastern Ukraine, and yes, western Ukraine. So this does not come as a surprise to the American intelligence and national security community. What it shows is that Vladimir Putin is frustrated by the fact that his forces are not making the kind of progress that he thought that they would make against major cities, including Kyiv. That he is expanding the number of targets. That he is lashing out.
Created by the Hitlerites, but he was killed by a Russian strike, which hit an ordinary Kharkiv multi-story building. With each day of this war, it becomes more obvious what denazification means to them.
Russia has summoned the U.S. ambassador to Moscow to deliver a formal complaint over President Joe Biden's recent remark calling Vladimir Putin a war criminal. The diplomatic row threatens to sever relations between Moscow and Washington for the first time since the U.S. recognized the Soviet Union in 1933. On Monday, President Biden claimed Putin's considering the use of chemical weapons in Ukraine, though Biden cited no evidence.
And so his back is against the wall, and he's talking about new false flags he's setting up, including he's asserting that we, America, have biological as well as chemical weapons in Europe. Simply not true. I guarantee you. They're also suggesting that Ukraine has biological and chemical weapons in Ukraine. That's a clear sign he's considering using both of those.
The Pentagon's identified the four U.S. Marines who were killed Friday after their plane crashed in a remote region of Norway. The crash of the Marines' V-22 Osprey came as the U.S.-led NATO allies in a series of massive war games known as Cold Response. About 30,000 troops from 27 countries are taking part, making it one of NATO's largest military exercises since the end of the Cold War. NATO says the drills are unrelated to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. A Russian judge has declared opposition leader Alexei Navalny guilty of fraud and contempt of court in a trial denounced by human rights groups as a politically motivated sham. Navalny is Vladimir Putin's best-known domestic critic. He's been jailed since last year at a penal colony east of Moscow after he survived a nerve agent attack in 2020. The Kremlin denied involvement in the assassination attempt. Prosecutors have asked to add a 13 years to Navalny's 3.5-year sentence on a previous charge that human rights groups have also rejected. Navalny's spokesperson said the guilty verdict was expected.
This is not a surprise that Putin would like to keep Alexei in prison for as long as he is in power. We are completely sure that this is his direct order to imprison Alexei.
Last year, Amnesty International revoked prisoner of conscience status for Navalny after video emerged of him making hateful, xenophobic and violent comments about Muslims and immigrants. Amnesty says it will continue to fight for Navalny's freedom. Japan's renounced Russia's decision to withdraw from World War II peace talks more than 76 years after the Soviet Union ended hostilities with Japan. The two sides never signed a peace treaty to formally conclude the war and have been locked in a dispute over territorial rights to the Kuril Islands, which Japan calls its northern territories. Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida on Monday blamed Russia for walking away from peace talks.
This entire situation has been created by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and Russia's response to push this onto Japan-Russia relations is extremely unfair and completely unacceptable. Japan would like to strongly protest against this.
Afghanistan's health ministry says widespread malnutrition is leading to a surge of premature births and infant deaths. The ministry estimates that since January, more than 13,000 newborn babies have died from malnutrition and hunger-related diseases. That's more than 6 infant deaths per hour. Some 3.5 million children need nutritional support. 95% of Afghanistan's population does not have enough to eat. Human Rights Watch says U.S.-led sanctions are impairing Afghans' basic human rights to life, food, health care and jobs. The group says Afghanistan urgently needs a functioning banking system to address its hunger crisis, with U.S. sanctions and Afghanistan's central bank making large transactions impossible. The U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee has opened historic confirmation hearings for President Biden's Supreme Court nominee, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, to fill retiring Justice Stephen Breyer's upcoming vacancy. Judge Jackson currently sits on D.C.'s federal appellate court and is the first black woman nominated to serve on the Supreme Court and the first former public defender. During her opening remarks, Judge Jackson defended her nearly decade-long record as a federal judge.
I have been a judge for nearly a decade now, and I take that responsibility and my duty to be independent very seriously. I decide cases from a neutral posture. I evaluate the facts, and I interpret and apply the law to the facts of the case before me without fear or favor, consistent with my judicial oath.
After headlines, we'll hear extended remarks from Judge Jackson and speak with Fatima Goss Graves of the National Women's Law Center. The United Nations top official warned Monday the Paris Agreement's goal of limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius is on life support. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said countries would need to cut global emissions nearly in half by 2030 in order to have a chance of reaching the 1.5 degree target.
Last year alone, global energy-related CO2 emissions grew by 6% to their highest level in history. Coal emissions have surged to record highs. We are sleepwalking to climate catastrophe. Our planet has already warmed by as much as 1.2 degrees, and we see the devastating consequences everywhere. If we continue with more of the same, we can kiss 1.5 goodbye. Even 2 degrees may be out of reach.
Guterres said countries that are looking to replace Russian oil and gas should invest heavily in renewables rather than pumping more oil or drilling new wells. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission has unveiled a draft rule that would require publicly traded companies to document how their activities contribute to the climate crisis. Under the rule, corporations would be required to report greenhouse gas emissions from their own operations as well as from the energy they consume. The public will have 60 days to comment on the proposal. And Chinese media reports rescue crews have found no signs of survivors in the wreckage of a passenger jet that crashed Monday in the southern region of Guangxi. President Xi Jinping has ordered an investigation into how the plane fell more than 25,000 feet in just 2 minutes. The U.S. National Transportation Safety Board has assigned an investigator for the crash since it involved a U.S.-made Boeing 737-800. The aircraft has an excellent safety record, unlike Boeing's 737 MAX, which had software flaws that led to crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia 3 years ago that killed all 346 people on board. In the headlines, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the Senate Judiciary Committee began historic confirmation hearings Monday for President Biden's Supreme Court nominee, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, to replace retiring Justice Stephen Breyer. Once a clerk for Breyer, Judge Jackson now sits on D.C.'s federal appellate court. If confirmed, she would become the first black woman to serve on the Supreme Court and the first former public defender. Her parents, her husband, her daughters attended Monday's hearing, where she was introduced by University of Pennsylvania Cary Law professor Lisa Fairfax and former George W. Bush-appointed U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Thomas Griffith. Before she spoke, senators made opening statements. Today and Wednesday, she's answering questions from the senators. This is Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey.
I know tomorrow and the coming hearings, we're going to have tough, hard questions. But please, let me just acknowledge the fact that this is not normal. It's never happened before. The Senate is poised right now to break another barrier. We are on the precipice of shattering another ceiling, another glass ceiling. It's a ceiling. It's a sign that we as a country are continuing to rise to our collective cherished highest ideals. I just feel this sense of overwhelming joy as I see you sitting there, as I see your family sitting behind you.
Meanwhile, Republicans use their opening remarks to attack Judge Jackson's work as a public defender, her representation of people detained at Guantanamo Bay, and to raise questions about what some said were her, quote, lenient sentences as a judge in child pornography cases. This is Republican Senator Josh Hawley.
What concerns me, and I've been very candid about this, is that in every case, in each of these seven, Judge Jackson handed down a lenient sentence that was below what the federal guidelines recommended and below what prosecutors requested. And so I think there's a lot to talk about there, and I look forward to talking about it.
After sitting through nearly 4 hours of opening statements from senators, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson addressed the committee. She vowed to be an independent judge who knows her, quote, limited role. These are part of her remarks.
The first of my many blessings is the fact that I was born in this great nation a little over 50 years ago in September of 1970. Congress had enacted two civil rights acts in the decade before, and like so many who had experienced lawful racial segregation firsthand, my parents, Johnny and Ellery Brown, left their hometown of Miami, Florida, and moved to Washington, D.C. to experience new freedom. When I was born here in Washington, my parents were public school teachers, and to express both pride in their heritage and hope for the future, they gave me an African name, Ketanji Onyeka, which they were told means lovely one. My parents taught me that unlike the many barriers that they had had to face growing up, my path was clearer, so that if I worked hard and I believed in myself in America, I could do anything or be anything I wanted to be. During this hearing, I hope that you will see how much I love our country and the Constitution and the rights that make us free. I stand on the shoulders of so many who have come before me, including Judge Constance Baker Motley, who was the first African-American woman to be appointed to the federal bench and with whom I share a birthday. And like Judge Motley, I have dedicated my career to ensuring that the words engraved on the front of the Supreme Court building, equal justice under law, are a reality and not just an ideal.
Part of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's opening remarks at the first day of her historic Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Before she spoke, activists rallied outside the Supreme Court in support of her nomination.
It is personal if you have ever wondered, is that for me?
Yes.
It is personal when she will take her seat and we get to watch her break that glass ceiling.
That was Fatima Goss-Graves, president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center, speaking at Monday's rally in D.C. She joins us now for more. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Fatima Goss-Graves. Can you talk about the significance of Judge Jackson's nomination, and then the issues raised by the Republicans, who clearly are staking out, well, in a number of cases, we've got some presidential aspirants on the Judiciary Committee and raising issues that actually had nothing to do with her.
You know, yesterday we started the morning with a really joyful intergenerational rally for a reason, because it's a big deal to be at this point in history. It's a big deal, not just for my generation, who maybe never thought that you would actually see a Black woman nominated to the Supreme Court, but for younger generations who now can see themselves not just as potentially a Supreme Court justice, you know, they can see themselves in so many different fields, and that mattered. We had young girls speaking at the rally yesterday, and hearing from their perspective what it meant to them was really heartwarming. And Judge Jackson, as you just saw, is a phenomenal nominee. She is so highly qualified. She is so highly credentialed. But actually, I think what has broken through is her character and her integrity. And so witnessing her raise her hand, witnessing her give her opening statement and her view of the law and how serious she takes the role of being a judge, that was also an important thing yesterday, too.
And Fatima Goss-Graves, could you talk a little bit about her her record in terms of her experience, especially representing Guantanamo Bay prisoners and currently serving as a federal judge on the U.S. U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia?
So Judge Jackson is in some ways unusual as a nominee because of the depth and breadth of her experience. She's been in private practice. She's been a federal public defender. She was on the U.S. Sentencing Commission. So she has had a wide range, and she's now been a district court judge and is a court of appeals judge at the moment. And what that means is she's going to bring a really broad understanding. Her experience as a federal public defender, though, is one that
And you're listening to WBAI in New York.
Understanding her experience as a federal public defender, though, is one that is so worthy of attention, in part because it means that the court would now have someone who has direct experience with people who are having contact with the criminal justice system. And the fact that we actually don't have anyone on the Supreme Court now who brings that experience says a lot. The Supreme Court makes tons of decisions that impact the actual real lives of people who are facing criminal penalties. If you were watching the opening statements yesterday, you heard the sort of posturing that was coming in. And I expect that today and tomorrow she will get a lot of questions about her representation of criminal defendants, including in terms of Guantanamo. One of the things that has been really important, though, is to remind ourselves around why we actually have a justice system that allows everyone to have representation. That is core to our Constitution. Equal access to the law, equal access to justice is core. And that's not just something for the wealthy. It is actually for those who can't afford it. And that is the work that she did. That work is noble.
And given the highly partisan and sharply divided nature of the Senate in recent years, what's the importance of the fact that she's already been through the confirmation process in the Senate three different times?
Right. So this is Judge Jackson's fourth time before the Senate Judiciary Committee. She's been confirmed three times. She's gone through this same committee three times, all times with bipartisan support, including just last summer, where she had three Republicans join her in her nomination to the D.C. Circuit. And so some of what you're sort of seeing now, the posturing as if there are deep concerns around Judge Jackson's record, doesn't actually fall squarely into what they have done in the past. But listen, this is a very important nomination. I think it's important that there be robust conversation about her record, about the many different roles that she has had. That's why she's turned over thousands of pages. What's not okay are efforts to distort her record. The Senate Judiciary Committee is not a place for misinformation. This is not some area of the dark web or social media. This is a serious proceeding for a serious role, and it is worthy of that approach.
This is part of South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham's opening remarks Monday at Judge Jackson's confirmation hearing.
Now, when we say this is not Kavanaugh, what do we mean? It means that Democratic senators are not going to have their windows busted by groups. That's what it means. It means that no Republican senator is going to unleash on you an attack about your character when the hearing is virtually over. None of us, I hope, have been sitting on information about you as a person for weeks or months. You come into our offices and we never share it with you to allow you to give your side of the story. We wait to the very last minute when the hearing's about to be gavel concluded and say, oh, by the way, I've got this letter. And so happened that every media outlet in the country had the letter too. So the next morning there were headlines all over the country, really, accusing Judge Kavanaugh of being basically Bill Cosby. None of us are going to do that to you.
Fatima Ghost Graves, can you decode what he's saying and the significance of this? Also, Senator Blackburn criticized Judge Brown Jackson for supporting the 1619 Project, saying fundamentally it's calling America racist. Of course, she couldn't respond to any of these points because each one makes their statement.
You know, I think there are two related things that are happening. The first is that you're seeing some Republicans trying to rewrite history. They're trying to make us think that the totally outrageous nomination processes that we saw with Justice Kavanaugh, with Justice Amy Coney Barrett, were typical. They weren't. It was just 2018. So many of us were around in 2018 to actually witness and participate. I was in the hearing room for Justice Kavanaugh's nomination. And I will tell you, I still think about that hearing. I still think about the giant disservice that was done to very serious allegations of sexual violence. And it actually has come out in the last year that the FBI didn't actually do the investigation that was promised. So I'm not sure why they're bringing it up, but it absolutely has nothing to do with Judge Jackson. It's just an effort to make people think that those nomination processes were typical. They weren't. But the second thing that you are seeing, and I think, unfortunately, Judge Jackson is going to be subject to it today and tomorrow in serious ways, is sort of preparation and posturing for the 22 election. So you're going to hear about the themes that some of the Republicans plan to launch in that election. Again, those themes actually aren't related to her record. And I don't think the hearing room is the place for this sort of misinformation and distorting of her record that you're going to see around things like critical race theory, around the sort of attack that was levied around trans youth. But we are unfortunately going to see that in this hearing room.
Fatima Ghost Graves, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, what about this, a theme that was raised initially yesterday in terms of her sentencing in child pornography cases? What do you know about that?
I actually think that is one of the most giant disservices, and it doesn't surprise me that it's coming from Senator Josh Hawley. I think the thing that people should know as he tries to mischaracterize her record is that she has sentenced more than 100 defendants proportionately to the crimes that they have committed and in lines with other judges. That's a thing that he knows, but he is still trying to mislead the public about her record. And it's why she has the clear support from the law enforcement community. So this is a nonsense issue. He's doing it, though, to make people confused about her record. It's unfortunate.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us. And at 9 each day, at least at this point, we understand the hearings will begin at 9 Eastern time today,
right,
Wednesday and Thursday. We'll be live streaming them at democracynow.org for people to watch. Fatima Ghost Graves, thanks so much for being with us. President and CEO of the National Women's Law Center.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we look at Russia's siege of Mariupol. We'll speak to a Human Rights Watch researcher who's just left Ukraine after interviewing survivors who managed to escape the devastation. Stay with us.
And you're listening to WBAI New York. This is Democracy Now! Remember to become a WBAI buddy. Our pledge line, 212-209-2950. Give to WBAI.org, or you can join our Tower Fund, towerfund.wbai.org, or send your check to Pacifica, WBAI, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. And, of course, you can always become a WBAI buddy, and from your bank account to WBAI's every month, 10, 20, whatever you can afford, spread out over a year or longer. a BAI buddy.
On Ukrainian themes, Opus 18, Dumka Shumka, composed by Mykola Lysenko, who is often called the father of modern Ukrainian classical music. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Russian forces of reducing the southern city of Mariupol to ashes. Tens of thousands of civilians remain trapped in the strategic port city with little food or water. There are now no foreign journalists in the city to document the destruction. A team of reporters from the Associated Press recently left Mariupol after spending 20 days in the besieged city. By the end, the reporters said they were being hunted down by Russian forces. AP video journalist Mstislav Chernov has provided a harrowing account of life under bombardment in Mariupol. I want to read a part of his description of what he witnessed. For our television audience, we'll also show images of Mariupol by Sergei Makarov, the photographer from the area. They were provided to us by Human Rights Watch. These are the words of AP's Mstislav Chernov. He writes, "One bomb at a time, the Russians cut electricity, water, food supplies, and finally, crucially, the cell phone, radio, and television towers. The few other journalists in the city got out before the last connections were gone and a full blockade settled in. The deaths came fast. On February 27th, we watched as a doctor tried to save a little girl hit by shrapnel. She died. A second child died, then a third. Ambulances stopped picking up the wounded because people couldn't call them without a signal, and they couldn't navigate the bombed-out streets. Shelling hit the hospital and the houses around. It shattered the windows of our van, blew a hole into its side, and punctured a tire. Sometimes we would run out to film a burning house and then run back amidst the explosions. By this time, I'd witnessed deaths at the hospital, corpses in the streets, dozens of bodies shoved into a mass grave. I'd seen so much death that I was filming almost without taking it in. On March 9th, twin airstrikes shredded the plastic taped over our van's windows. I saw the fireball just a heartbeat before pain pierced my inner ear, my skin, my face. We watched smoke rise from a maternity hospital. When we arrived, emergency workers were still pulling bloodied pregnant women from the ruins." Those are the words of the Associated Press's Mstislav Chernov, who spent 20 days in Mariupol documenting the Russian siege. To talk more about the humanitarian crisis there and across Ukraine, we're joined by Belkis Vile, senior researcher with the Conflict and Crisis Division at Human Rights Watch. She just left Ukraine, where she spent over 3 weeks. Human Rights Watch has published a new report, largely based on her research, titled Ukraine: Ensure Safe Passage, Aid for Mariupol Civilians. Residents describe harsh conditions during Russian attack. She's joining us now from Zurich, Switzerland. Belkis, thanks so much for being here. I know you must be dealing with so much trauma now as you took in the trauma of these testimonies. Describe what you heard from the Mariupol survivors.
I mean, what I heard was truly, as I think you've already depicted well, an absolute hellscape. You know, families were telling me about how they were flushing out the water in their heating systems to try and get access to more water to survive, as they spent over 2 weeks in basements sheltering from the constant shelling around them before they were eventually able to get into, you know, their own personal vehicles and cars that their friends had and get outside the city. They were also melting snow to get water and going to local streams and rivers. And all of them said that, you know, waiting on these lines, even at local fountains and streams, meant that you were essentially at risk of being shelled. They would go outside of their basements only to cook food on open flame in their yards. And it was in those times when they left their basements that they would see dead bodies strewn outside, dead bodies of people that they knew, families who would say, you know, we can't even bury our son who was killed in an explosion nearby because the shelling continues and it's not safe to bury him yet. The stories were really horrific. I would say perhaps the most difficult stories to hear, though, were from older people and people with disabilities. They, when the electricity was cut, unlike everyone else in the city who went down into these basements to shelter, they couldn't do that because no electricity meant they couldn't take elevators down. And so they sat on their sofas in apartments. You know, I spoke to a man in his 80s. He lived on the sixth floor of his building, sat on his sofa with windows blown out, so no glass between him and these below freezing temperatures, just watching the shelling and the explosions and the fires from outside his window, hoping that he would survive.
And Belkacem, Human Rights Watch has reported the extensive use of cluster munitions by the Russian forces in some places. Could you talk about what you found about that?
Unfortunately, since this conflict has begun, we have seen multiple instances of Russian forces firing cluster munitions into civilian populated areas. We saw that in the very early days when the conflict began in Donetsk. We then saw the cluster munitions being used on multiple occasions in the city of Kharkiv, the second biggest city in Ukraine that has been heavily, heavily damaged in recent attacks. And we've even seen cluster munitions used elsewhere in the country. We issued a report on the use on numerous days in numerous attacks of cluster munitions in the city of Mykolaiv near Odessa. And in these instances, unfortunately, we have seen civilians injured and killed.
And there have been reported instances of violations of attempts at ceasefires in an effort to create humanitarian corridors. What have you found about that? And how have so many people been able to leave despite the lack of an organized form of humanitarian relief through these corridors?
Officials have tried to negotiate humanitarian corridors, including with the help of independent institutions like the International Committee of the Red Cross, and numerous times have said that these, you know, efforts to put in place a short-term ceasefire to allow for a humanitarian corridor to open have failed. The idea is that these corridors would allow for civilians to safely evacuate areas of fighting, but also that urgently needed humanitarian aid could get into areas where, you know, there are going to be some civilians that simply can't flee. Some people, as I mentioned, you know, older people, people with disabilities, other people who can't leave or don't want to leave the areas that they live in. I would say it's important to note that ultimately the obligation on both sides is to allow civilians to flee safely and for aid to get in, regardless of whether corridors exist or not. The people of Mariupol waited for days, waiting for news that a corridor would be put in place so that they could evacuate in an organized fashion and evacuate safely. And after days and days and days of waiting, where each of these corridors failed, it was around March 14th that a few people simply decided enough is enough. Either I'm going to die in my basement or I'm going to die trying to leave the city, and I prefer the latter option. So they got into their cars and they just started driving. They knew they were driving into Russian-controlled territory, but eventually were hoping they would make it to the Ukrainian side. One car led to five cars, led to 10 cars. And then on March 14, as I said, this number grew, and we heard in the news suddenly that 160 cars were trying to make it to the Ukrainian side. And that's when my colleague and I actually headed to the area where we knew people would be arriving once they made it to back into Ukrainian-controlled territory in the city of Zaporizhia. And then we stayed there for 2 days interviewing some of the thousands of people that then also got into their own vehicles and took the risk of making it out of the city and arriving to safety.
Belkis, you talk about people getting into their own vehicles. What about people who don't have them, the most compromised people, the poorest, the disabled, the old?
Absolutely. That's the thing that everyone that I interviewed raised with me. They said, you know, we were sheltering for weeks in a basement with 50 other people, 80 other people. When we heard that cars were trying to get out, we got into our car. Maybe, you know, half the people, a quarter of the people who were sheltering with us also had cars and left, but we left behind the others. And these are people who didn't have private vehicles, who don't have the means to leave. And I think the sad reality is that, you know, the people that we spoke to were the lucky ones. They were the ones with the means and the ability to get out of the city. We know from local authorities that they estimate at least 200,000 people are still in the city. And as you say, many of them simply don't have the means to get out. And that's why it is so important that humanitarian aid can get into the city, where food stocks are dwindling, where medication is running out, and where so much assistance is urgently needed.
I wanted to ask you about more about Kharkiv, the eastern city. These are the voices of volunteers who clean debris from residential buildings that have been attacked.
A girl that was walking opposite the medical center was killed. A man wounded with shrapnel in his lungs and another part of his body is laying near entrance 5. He was going back home when it happened. He was hit by shrapnel. He's a lieutenant colonel in the reserve. Who else got hit? A grandmother was killed. Her grandson is disabled.
Honestly speaking, I do not see much sense in leaving the city. Joining Territorial Defense Force? I do not have any military experience, but I can help the city with my labor. Why not?
At the moment, I do not have any work at home. I am 70. I am an engineer with experience. Until yesterday, I had work to do, but when I saw the appeal, I understood this was more urgent, more important, more needed now.
So those are the voices of volunteers in Kharkiv. You also have Human Rights Watch documenting Russia's use of cluster munitions, particularly in another city under siege in Mykolaiv. If you could talk about these attacks as well and what you've documented.
In the city of Kharkiv, we initially were documenting several distinct uses of cluster munitions in the city at a time when many civilians were still there, cluster munitions that did injure and kill civilians. And we more recently have published a much more detailed report that actually looks at 43 individual attacks on civilian property, shops, homes, other common spaces that civilians use, to the point that the city has been so severely damaged. And during the time that these attacks were rocking the city, there wasn't any safe corridor out. There wasn't an easy way for civilians to leave. And that's unfortunately why so many were wounded and killed in those attacks. And then, as you said, the fighting has proceeded on other fronts. The city of Mykolaiv in the last days has been under heavy shelling and attack. There is a military airbase in the city. There is a military factory in the city. But the areas where we've seen cluster munitions landing are also in residential neighborhoods. In other parts of the city, we've interviewed people who've had munitions landing in the middle of their house while they and their family were still there. And unfortunately, these attacks will continue to wound and kill civilians.
I wanted to ask you about the role of countries like Poland in welcoming millions of Ukrainians who are fleeing the war. And they've gotten a lot of media attention for that. But at the same time, Poland has continued to close its borders to Syrian, Libyan, Yemenis and peoples from Africa who are fleeing the devastation in their own countries. For example, on March 2nd, according to press reports, the Polish border guard tweeted, quote, "Last night, 51 foreigners tried to illegally cross into Poland from Belarus. 11 people from Syria, 33 from Iraq, 1 from Burkina Faso, and 6 from the Congo were arrested." Now, this is an area, the Belarus border, where foreign journalists are not allowed, while the foreign journalists are allowed to film and report on the refugees being welcomed from Ukraine. What does this say about the nature of the human rights implications of one group of people being treated one way and another group of people being treated another way?
I think that's such an important point to make. I crossed the border out of Ukraine into Poland on Sunday, and I was simply astounded by what I saw. As I crossed the border, I saw dozens of tents from numerous organizations from around the world. As I was getting my bearings straight and figuring out which direction to go in, a man handed me a steaming cup of coffee. Another woman handed me a bowl of soup. Someone was offering me a free SIM card. There were people distributing diapers, baby food, providing free transport to cities in Poland. I mean, this response is incredible. It's the welcome that Ukrainians and foreigners in Ukraine who flee from the country are facing is amazing, but at the same time stands in such stark contrast to what we've seen at the Polish border, the Polish-Belarus border, only in November, when we saw people being pushed back illegally across the border back into Belarus. We saw people freezing to death in the forests and being beaten by border guards. And as you say, you know, it's not like volunteer organizations hadn't wanted to provide assistance at that point to people stuck on the border, but they weren't allowed to. So I think it is disturbing to see this difference. And all I can hope is that now that we've seen what a welcoming response can look like and should look like, that that is extended to all refugees and asylum seekers that are fleeing war.
In fact, didn't you go into Ukraine to investigate what was happening to African students, for example, who were trying to flee Ukraine?
In the first days of the war, in particular, we had a country, Ukraine is a country that has many tens of thousands of foreign students that study there, students from India, Nigeria, China, Morocco, all over the world. And when the conflict started, you saw many people trying to get on trains and buses to get to the border with Poland and other borders. And priority was being given to Ukrainian women and Ukrainian children. And that those spaces on buses and on trains were actually being prevented for boarding for many foreign students. I interviewed many students who eventually made it to the western city of Lviv, Indian students, Moroccan students, Algerian students, and they described to me how they were pushed off of buses, they were pushed off of trains, they were prevented from boarding because, you know, local authorities were telling them priority is given to Ukrainian women and children, not to you.
Belkis Vile, we want to thank you for being with us. Senior researcher with the Conflict and Crisis Division at Human Rights Watch, just left Ukraine, where she spent over 3 weeks documenting the effects of the war across the country. Human Rights Watch has published a new report largely based on her research, and we will link to it at democracynow.org. Coming up, we'll speak with a pacifist in Kyiv. Stay with us.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, and that is Democracy Now!, which is heard here every morning, beginning at 8 a.m. WBAI, your source for news and information. Stay tuned. Democracy Now! Will soon return. And remember, you can be a BAI buddy. Call our pledge line, 212-209-2950, or go to our donation site, give2wbai.org. Or you can send your check, address it to Pacifica-WBAI, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. Make sure you sign that check and that you write to Pacifica-WBAI.
Obimoe by the Ukrainian rock band Okean Elzi. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Kyiv, Ukraine, where we're joined by Yuri Shalyachenko. He's the executive secretary of the Ukrainian Pacifist Movement and a board member of the European Bureau for Conscientious Objection. Yuri is also a member of the board of directors at World Beyond War and a research associate at Kroc University in Kyiv, Ukraine. He's been closely following reports from the the occupied southern Ukraine city of Kherson, where Russian forces used stun grenades and machine gun fire to disperse a crowd of hundreds of people who gathered Monday to protest the Russian occupation. Yuri, welcome back to Democracy Now. You are still in Kyiv. Can you talk about what's happening now and what you're calling for? And I'm particularly interested, for example, in what seems to be an almost unanimous call for a no-fly zone, so Russia can't pummel the cities. But the West is deeply concerned that enforcing a no-fly zone, meaning shooting down Russian planes, will lead to a nuclear war. And what your position is on this?
Thank you, Emmy, and greetings to all peace-loving people around the world. Of course, no-fly zone is a militarized response to current crisis, and what do we need is not escalation of conflict with more weapons, more sanctions, more hatred toward Russia and China, but of course, instead of that, we needed comprehensive peace talks. And you know, United States is not non-involvement a part of this conflict. On the contrary, this conflict is beyond Ukraine. It has two tracks, conflict between the West and East and conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Expansion of NATO was previous to violent power grabs in Kyiv by sponsored by the West Ukrainian nationalists in 2014 and violent power grabs in Crimea and Donbass by Russian nationalists and Russian military forces the same year. So 2014, it was, of course, a year of starting this violent conflict from the start between government and between separatists. And then after a major battle, after conclusion of peace deal, Minsk agreements, which both sides are not complied with, and we see objective reports of OSCE about ceasefire violations on both sides, and these ceasefire violations were escalated before Russian invasion, this illegal Russian invasion to Ukraine, and whole problem is that peaceful solution on that time, internationally approved by United Nations Security Council, was not complied with. And now we see that instead of Biden, Zelensky, Putin, Xi Jinping sit at one negotiation table, discuss how to transform this world for better, to remove any hegemony and to establish harmony. Instead of that, we have this politics of threats from United States to Russia, from United States to China, this demands of war-mongering Ukrainian civil society to establish this no-fly zone. And by the way, it is incredible hatred towards Russian in Ukraine, and this hatred is spreading around the world, not only to war-mongering regime, but for Russian people too. But we see that Russian people, many of them are against this war. And you know, I am thankful to all courageous people who resist non-violently to war and war-mongering. Those people who protested against Russian occupation of Ukrainian city of Kherson and invading army shooted at them. It is a shame. You know, there are a lot of people pursuing nonviolent way of life in Ukraine. Number of conscientious objectors to military service in our country who conducted alternative service before Russian invasion was 1,659. This number is from annual report 2029 on conscientious objection to military service. Service published by the European Bureau for Conscientious Objection. The report concludes that Europe was not a safe place in 2021 for many conscientious objectors in several countries, in Ukraine, in Russia, and Russian-occupied Crimea and Donbas. In Turkey, Turkish-occupied northern part of Cyprus. In Azerbaijan, Armenia, Belarus, and other countries, conscientious objectors to military service faced prosecution, arrest, trials by military courts, imprisonments, fines, intimidation, attacks, death threats, discrimination. In Ukraine, critique of army and advocacy of conscientious objection is considered as treason and punished. Thousands of people were arrested and fined at anti-war rallies in Russia. I would like to quote statement of the movement of conscientious objectors to military service in Russia from this EPCO annual report. Quote, what is happening in Ukraine is a war unleashed by Russia. Conscientious objectors movement condemns the Russian military aggression and calls on Russia to stop the war. Conscientious objectors movement call on the Russian soldiers not participate in hostilities, do not become war criminals. Conscientious objectors movement calls on all recruits to refuse military service, apply for alternative civilian service, or try to be exempted on medical grounds. End of quote. And of course, Ukrainian pacifist movement also condemns militarized response of Ukraine and this stalling of negotiations, which we see now is a result of pursuance of military solution.
Yuri, I just wanted to ask you, because we have only a few minutes left. You talk about the direct involvement of the U.S. and NATO already. There's been very little reporting that not just on the issue of the weapons being supplied by the West to Ukraine, but also clearly by the actual satellite surveillance data that the Ukrainian army is most likely receiving from the West. And my guess is years from now, we will learn that drone attacks on Russian forces were being directed remotely from American bases in places like Nevada, or even that there are already significant number of CIA and special operation forces inside Ukraine. As you say, there are nationalists on all sides, on Russia, in the U.S., and in Ukraine, who have fueled this this crisis right now. I'm wondering your sense of what the resistance is among the Ukrainian people to this war. How widespread has it grown?
This escalation is a result of push from these military contractors. We know that American Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is linked to Raytheon. He was on board of directors, and we know that Raytheon stocks have 6% growth on New York Stock Exchange, and they supply Stingers missiles to Ukraine. Producer of Javelin missiles, Thales, have a growth 38%, and of course we have this Lockheed Martin. They supply F-35 fighter jets. They have a growth of 14%, and they profit from war, and they push for war, and they even hope to profit more from bloodshed, from destruction, and somehow do not escalate for the scale of nuclear war. People should push to government to negotiate instead of fight. There are a lot of actions against warmongering going ahead in the United States and Europe. You can find announcement at the worldbeyondwar.org website under the banner Russia out of Ukraine, NATO out of existence. Code Pink continues to petition President Biden and the United States Congress for negotiation instead of escalation. Also, it will be global mobilization stop Lockheed Martin on April 28. Coalition No to NATO announced the marching in June 2022 for this and against the NATO summit in Madrid. In Italy, Movimento Non Violento launched conscientious objection election campaign in solidarity with conscientious objectors, draft evaders, Russian and Ukrainian deserters. In Europe, Europe for Peace campaign said that European nonviolent pacifists issue ultimatum to Putin and Zelensky. Stop the war immediately or people will organize caravans of nonviolent pacifists from all over Europe using all possible means to travel to the conflict zones unarmed to act as peacekeepers among the combatants. As for protesting in Ukraine, for example, we have this
Yuri, we have shameful, 5 seconds.
I would like to say that a petition entitled Allow Men Aged from 18 to 60 Without Military Experience.
Joy of Resistance. We're sisters of the joy of resistance.
March is Women's History Month, dedicated to putting women back into histories written by men and about men. Every Thursday in March at 11 a.m., Joy of Resistance will bring you special women's history programming. We will cover the reproductive justice movement that brought a woman of color spin to reproductive rights, black women leaders of the civil rights movement, the FBI assault on the women's movement, the political history of the bra, and how book banning by the right wing is erasing women's history today. And that's only some of it. That's 11 a.m. on Thursdays in March. Women's history as you've never known it.
And you're listening to WBAI in New York. Stay tuned for the next program, Law of